You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Specialist in public health medicine, Dr. Liang also worked in the Hong Kong government civil service for many years, including in the important post of Undersecretary for Food and Health and the Director of the Chief Executive's Office. Representing Seoul, we have Dao Chung Lee. Mr. Lee is Director of the Development Finance Division at the Ministry of Economy and Finance in the Republic of South Korea. He oversees Korea's development finance cooperation policy and participates in the International Development Programs Committee and the Prime Minister's Office. And finally, from Taipei, we are joined by Yi Zhong Lai, who is the President of Prospect Foundation. He has had a distinguished career in both the public service and the think tanks, serving as Director General of the Development of International Affairs in the Democratic Progressive Party and a Special Assistant for Policy to the Taiwan representative to Japan. We welcome this truly distinguished group of experts with first-hand experience in the region. The panel will be moderated by my Brookings colleague, Dr. Jonathan Strauss, who previously lived and worked in Asia for almost 2 decades, is Asia Foundation's representative there. Before joining Brookings in 2017, he served on the U.S. Secretary of State's policy planning staff, advising policies on China, East and Southeast Asia. Now, please note that we will be taking questions today by email and our Twitter account, as John just mentioned, at Brookings China. I will now turn over the program to Jonathan, who will guide the first panel discussion. Over to you, Jonathan.
Well, thank you very much, Cheng, for your thoughtful remarks and the handoff. And I think we should get right into it and get started. And I would like to first invite Professor Zhang to give a presentation and just ask everybody to try to keep the remarks to 5 to 7 minutes. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Jonathan. I will now share my screen with the PowerPoint slide. Let's see. Are you able to see my slide?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. Right. Great. Well, thank you very much. My pleasure to be here today, and thank you to the Brookings Institution for putting together this very timely panel. I would like to share with you Vietnam and Hanoi's experience with COVID-19. So as you have mentioned, Vietnam, by official numbers, have reported an astonishing success. As of today, there's 313 confirmed cases, including 0 death. And I'd be happy to talk more about weighting the credibility of these numbers during the Q&A if there's interest about that. But by official number measures, Vietnam has certainly been successful. Now, as any Vietnamese would tell you, it is very difficult to get to compel people in Vietnam to do anything. So what contributes to this success in combating COVID-19? In this short remark, in the interest of time, I want to highlight 2 key features. First is the fact that Vietnam's state capacity wasn't born overnight, but it is the result of decades-long effort to improve governance at local levels. And second, one manifestation of that is the close level of central-local coordination displayed during the fight against COVID-19, as exemplified by the example of Hanoi that I will go through. So these two features contribute to Vietnam's success and will likely remain important and critical as it slowly reopens its economy. Now, in the interest of time, I will go through just one example of each of these features. So first, on improving governance, one key area that has benefited is access to health. And here we have the benefit of data from PAPI, which is an annual survey ran by a joint project between the UNDP and the Vietnamese authority that surveys citizens in all provinces on their satisfaction with local leaders. So these data show here in this first set of graph that, and you might not be able to see the numbers, but I will read it out to you, that the percent of citizens with health insurance in Vietnam by 2019 has reached over 90%. And in the lower graph, you can see Hanoi, which is the red line, even though it lagged behind other major cities in early years, have caught up. Now, at the same time that access to health has increased, respondents have also reported a decrease in demands for hospital bribes. So this second set of graphs show the percent of respondents who did not have to pay bribes when using hospital services. In 2011, that was 45%. Meaning that half of the people, more than half of the people, had to pay hospital bribes. In 2019, it's 67%. Now, that still means that a third of the people who use hospital services paid bribe. So there's room for improvement there, but clearly there's a positive trend. And so these data, taken together with the government policy to provide centralized quarantines free of charge, largely free of charge, taken together with data for better access to health and decrease in formal and informal healthcare costs, that taken together illustrated that the likelihood for compliance with restrictive COVID-19 measures, such as required testing, hospitalization, and quarantines, there's a high likelihood, a higher likelihood for compliance because of these regulatory measures. Now, moving on to central local coordinations. So I want to talk about Hanoi, which is the capital of Vietnam and where I am from. So Hanoi is politically important, and it has also been the epicenter of the COVID-19 outbreaks in Vietnam. So coordination here in Hanoi's example is both upward and downward. So upward, it has coordinated with the Ministry of Health, the People's Army, and Specialized Pandemic Response Unit. To combat the disease. And here are just some examples. Here is a photo of the, it's called the Special Hanoi High Command Unit, which is an army unit under the Department of Defense, showing here disinfecting a hospital in Vietnam, which was a hotbed of COVID-19 outbreaks. And unlike some of its neighboring neighbors like Thailand, the Vietnamese army generally has received high level of public trust and confidence flowing from its role in the resistance wars a couple of decades earlier. Here's another photo of a military of the centralized quarantine camp ran by army units. Here's an army officer helping, very nicely helping a lady move her luggage. But also equally critical is the level of coordination downwards. And I don't have a photo of this because most of this happened informally. But Hanoi has extensive coordination with lower level administration units, including district wards and villages under its administration to disseminate information, to knock on doors, to check on people's health history, travel history, making sure that people do not violate their quarantine orders. So as of April 23rd, the country has slowly reopened its society and economy. This photo here show the last quarantine neighborhood in Vietnam, which is in Hanoi, which just opened, which was released from social distancing last night. And as you can see here, traffic is already back. This is Vietnam infamous traffic. So of course, as any other country, Vietnamese leaders have to balance between economic revitalizations and public health. And yet, the two key features for Vietnam has been better governance and close local central coordinations. And these features will, I believe, remain critically important as it continues during this journey. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Zhang, for those remarks. And I think these themes of governance, perhaps some unique attributes of governance that are perhaps shared between these systems, despite very different kind of political regimes, for instance, is something that we should come back to as a theme. But let's keep moving. We're going to go through all of our presenters, four of them first, and then we'll have a discussion. So let me now please invite Dr. Leung to give a presentation on Hong Kong.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm just going to spend the next few minutes going through some of the lessons that Hong Kong has learned, which may help with the global pandemic control going forward. So here you see essentially Hong Kong's experience so far. This is from a New England Journal paper that I wrote and was published about a couple of weeks ago, showing the darker bars being the imported cases, and we had three phases of importation. The first phase, or the first batch of importations, were all from mainland China, mostly Hubei province. Then the second phase of importation were from the Diamond Princess cruise liner that actually disembarked at Yokohama in Japan. And then the third and the largest importation phase was the overseas student returnees from Europe and North America. The lighter bars are local cases. So as you can see, Hong Kong really hasn't had a very substantial first wave. And we would probably think that three sets of interventions have been responsible for the epidemic curve being relatively flat throughout our first wave. The first control knob on that panel of pandemic controls would be travel-related measures or border restrictions. And as you can see, Hong Kong started very early, and then progressively, as the pandemic spread, we progressively closed off entry to citizens from those regions to the extent that now Hong Kong has stopped all transit flights, as well as still are not allowing in non-Hong Kong residents. So that's one in terms of our border restrictions. Two, these are what we call case-based measures, and they are really rather medieval. They are actually quarantine and isolation. So they're focused on the case or the individual. Now, quarantine and isolation, we have actually done all these things, and I'm not going to belabor these details, but we have again layered on different intensities of quarantine and isolation measures to the extent that we're now quarantining all inbound passengers into Hong Kong via air, land, and sea for 14 days and requiring them to undergo a viral PCR test at the border. Then the third set of measures would be the community measures, and these are the physical distancing measures, ranging from school closures since the Lunar New Year. Schools have still been suspended, and then all the way to the closing of bars and entertainment venues and restricting group gatherings to no more than 8 people in public places. Now, we also have expanded our laboratory testing capacity to somewhere between 5,000 to 7,000 per day for a population of 7.5 million people. And so you can see that we've got from tier 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So there's 6 tiers that are progressively laid on, and they are really looking at casting a wider and wider net from undiagnosed inpatient pneumonia to all inpatient pneumonia to outpatients with respiratory symptoms in public clinics, at private clinics, and then all arriving travelers. And importantly, a lot of these screening samples are deep saliva samples or posterior oropharyngeal samples in medical lingo. And they have been shown, not just by us, but also by a group in Yale, as well as some German studies showing that they are just as sensitive as a screening PCR test. And these are the numbers of cases out of the roughly over 1,000 cases we've had so far, and the relative proportions arising from these six categories of testing. Now, here we actually show that a lot of clustering effect in our infections. And the majority of our infections are, of course, as I said, imported. The color code here is basically green are clusters of imported cases, so clusters being defined as any more than six in that transmission chain. Then clusters initiated by a local case, then clusters initiated by an imported case, and then about just under half are sporadic cases without known clustering effects. And in time, this is how they're distributed. Now, to look at it more closely, there are very big clusters, and Hong Kong's biggest cluster, which accounts for more than 10%, almost 15% of all local cases, is a case involving a bar cluster in Hong Kong's Lan Kwai Fong district, which is the sort of nightlife district in the central business area. And of course, these are other types of clusters, and the color codes refer to the setting. And what we found was, and the highlighted text in red really sort of captures what the over-dispersion parameter as well as the serial interval actually shows, is that actually 20% of cases are responsible for 80% of transmission events in Hong Kong. And that is really quite a high K, which is the, or kappa, which is the over-dispersion parameter that infectious disease modelers use. Now, there is limited spread from imported infections, and that's really very clearly seen. We've just isolated the imported cases here, so desegregating that epidemic curve overall that I just showed you, and then looking at the effective reproductive number, that is the RT, through time. As you can see, it really hadn't, except for this one blip, sort of peaked over one, which is the unity threshold. So as you can see, most imported cases, because they're very quickly identified and then isolated, they don't generally go on and cause infection chains. Now, there's of course been a massive reduction in inbound travel at our airport, for example, which of course is used to handling somewhere between 200 to 250,000 passengers a day. And really, now we've got somewhere around 1,000 passengers per day. But by March, so about a month and a half ago, we only went down to about 500 passengers per day, all right? Now, if you then look at the local cases, you can see that the local cases, there is a much bigger period or much bigger peak or crest during a slight relaxation of the working from home arrangements. That's a white zone here. Yellow are special work arrangements for civil servants, which are largely mirrored by the rest of the private sector. So as you can see, once you relax a little bit, the RT went back right up to the R0 level, which is round about two. But then once you close things off, then they come back down again. And this is very interesting, and it may point the way to what might happen if we are not quite as careful again. Now, this is my penultimate slide, and it is from another paper that we wrote in The Lancet, which really sort of shows that there are two parameters that's very important to look at when you reopen. That is the disease prevalence, that's basically the daily number of reported cases, and then the RT. R, everybody now knows, has to be one or below, but it's important that we look at the absolute number of daily reported cases or the daily incidents, because R of one just keeps it flat. So when you're at a low level, it's okay to keep R at one or just below one. But once you relax, and if you're not careful, if you don't actually do lots of testing and tracing, then you allow R to grow, pushing the daily incidence to a fairly high level. And then even if you apply the measures again to tighten up again and push R back down to one, you are just merely keeping this on a high burn rate. So you would have to apply even extra effort for a prolonged period of time, sometimes as much as 7 or 8 times as much time as when you had relaxed, in order to push it back down way below one so as to get back to where you were. So this is a cautionary note from a modeling framework about reopening. Now, Dr. of course, we're very mindful.
I ask you to wrap up, please.
We're very mindful that health protection is but one direction or one part of the tension. The other two are economic preservation in terms of GDP and employment, and social consent or acceptance and emotional well-being of the population dealing with those very, very strict and drastic physical distancing measures. And of course, we also do psychobehavioral surveillance to look at all sorts of different risk perceptions, personal protective behaviors, and so on throughout on a weekly basis. Over.
Thank you very much. And that was a fascinating and incredibly informative look at how Hong Kong has dealt with the problem. And also, I think, points to some interesting possibilities for the future in terms of best practices for the rest of us. Now I'd like to invite Dr. Dai-Jung Lee to come into the discussion and tell us a little bit about South Korea and Seoul in particular.
Well, thank you and good morning and good evening to those joining from the Asia Pacific. It is my great pleasure to speak on Brookings web seminar on reopening and revitalization of Asia. Throughout the COVID-19 outbreak in Korea, central government and the local government has worked closely together with the civil society to preserve the freedom of the movement and the openness in daily life with the minimum amount of interference of the government. Even at the height of the pandemic in late February and early March, Korea has managed to contain the COVID-19 without resorting lockdown, blockade, suspension of public transportation, or other large-scale restriction. Central to this, our strategy can be identified with the 3T, that is the robust testing to identify and confirm positive cases. And this is able to do it with the national health insurance and the free to all domestic and international. And two is the contact tracing to prevent the further spread of virus. And number three on the rigorous treatment of those infected at the earliest possible stage. Since the mid-April, the number of new cases fell to around 10 cases a day in Korea, suggesting that we may be past the worst of the pandemic. However, with the recent case of infection spreading at the bars and nightclub district and imported cases, there is a consensus, for it is still premature to let down our guard against COVID-19. This morning, I'd like to talk about the two topics on reopening and revitalization of Korea in area of a social measure, and the next one is on economic measure. As a measure to navigate back to the normal life and revive society, there are three responses of Korea I would like to share with this panel. And first, it's a mandatory COVID-19 testing to all people coming to Korea. As we find it, 72% of a newly confirmed case among the overseas travel over the past 2 weeks. COVID-19 testing has been made mandatory for all inbound travelers at the port of entry starting the 11th of May. They are also required to undergo 14-day self-quarantine. Two is the transparency. Korea is committed to prompt and transparent sharing of information on development in our COVID-19 situation. And the government policy does both domestically and internationally. Our law, called Infectious Disease Control and Prevention Act, ensures the public right to be informed on the latest development and response of a pandemic. The law is embedded in the system. And third is social distancing. There are three stages of social distancing in Korea. Level 3 is highest, level 1 is lowest. And the government, with a quarantine expert, periodically review and update the COVID-19 comprehensively by looking at the four factors. The first factor is whether the average of number of new cases are under 50. And number 2, whether there are less than 5% of cases are from the unidentified infection route. Number 3, whether the specific quarantine network is able to manage it on its own. And finally, the numbers of size of cluster outbreak. Starting the 6th of May, social distancing has lowered to level 1. After the long social dialogue in drafting the detailed outline on code of conduct on the personal guideline and the community guideline. Now, next on the economy. It is economy that matters, and many experts, institutions has already compared this current economic crisis being compared to something happened in 100 years. This is no exception to Korea. Damage to Korean economy is indeed colossal as well. Our trade recorded for deficit in the first time in the 99 months, and there are quite a shock to employment and also our GDP. So this is undeniably an economic wartime situation. Against this backdrop, Korea revitalization economic measure is prepared. And let me summarize with the three P's, which is our protection, promotion, and preparation. First is protection the vulnerable and the jobs and business. The Korea has begun to paying out the emergency relief payment totaling $12 billion to all households starting the 11th of May. And the government has been providing liquidity to business, including the low interest rate to micro business and special guarantee to SMEs, and further government employment emergency employment security measure. Second is on the promotion of a resilient economic recovery. The government has been providing industry-specific support for industry that are hit hard by the pandemic, like airline, tourism, shipping, and also the cultures and art. And third is a preparation for the post COVID-19. The government is improving the business regulation on 10 sectors, namely data, AI, future car, medical, healthcare, fintech, and also recycling and tourism and e-commerce. And the Korean government is also pushing the so-called the Korean version of a New Deal as a national project, which is the preemptive investment for the future, as well as the prepare for the digital, the work will be the unveil. Finally, I'd like to conclude by my statement with 3 points. And let me say that this is too early to say any conclusion, but this is a summarizing point. First, when it comes to the COVID-19, it is not over until it's over. When it comes to reopening the revitalization of city, no one can say with confidence this is the right time, as it'll take a long time to the fight and tackle the COVID-19 completely. And we should also embrace for the possible pandemic second wave. And number 2, we still know very little about this virus. Next to China, Korea is the first country faced the outbreak of coronavirus. We're the first country able to flatten the curve on the outbreak. And we are also the first country hold the general election in the middle of the pandemic. However, we still do not know much about COVID-19. And if someone asks how and when did the virus arrive in Korea, what percentage of the population has had it, how lethal it is, and why some people do not have antibody even after the recovering the COVID-19. So it is important everyone to comply with the safety precaution and rules until the situation is over, even after the resuming the daily life. And finally, we really think the COVID-19 is a testing time to the all. And the virus sees no borders, you know, it doesn't respect races, and it doesn't respect, you know, well-being of peoples of country. Therefore, it is testing time for not only for the hospital and healthcare, it is testing time for the policymaker with the enormous amount of social and economic stress. And it is testing time for the student and teacher with 90% of school has been closed in worldwide. And most of all, you feel that COVID-19 is a detesting time for the international community and strong solidarity and cooperation. And to this end, Korea will work together to tackle COVID-19. And that will conclude my statement. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lee. I jotted down the, I appreciated the crispness of South Korea's response in terms of the three T's and the three P's, but I also appreciated your sober reminder about how much we don't know. The situation is very fluid as we try to think through kind of practical responses, not only for containment, but now moving forward. Finally, I would like to invite Mr. Lai from the Prospect Foundation in Taiwan to tell us more about the Taipei experience. Mr. Lai, are you there?
Hello? Did you hear me?
Can hear Hello? You. Yep. Please go ahead.
Yes, mm-hmm. Okay, good. Thank you. The Taiwan cases right now that we have accumulated about 440 cases. Unfortunately, we have 7 deaths. And among those 440 cases, already we have about 390 being discharged from the hospitals. And when we analyze the amount of 440 cases in terms of the sources, about 349 of them, they are imported, and the 55 of them, they are locally acquired. And we have another interesting category, that is 36 cases that came from in our Navy tour when they have the training navigations, and they acquired during the trip. So that's a special category. But basically, this is how the situation in Taiwan right now. But I also say that in Taiwan, we have about experienced 33 days of no zero local cases and 8 consecutive days of the no import cases. So that the people right now in Taiwan, basically our social activities and economic activity, we can still go on. We do not have the pressure to exercise very draconian limitation for the general public, their daily activities. Schools still opened. People go to the market and go to work, although with some adjustments. And because of the consecutive days of the zero cases, so the government right now already opened up the number of permitted audience to the baseball game or other large crowded areas. So that those are situations that we're in Taiwan. And when we look at the those developments, the relative success that we have here, I will attribute it to probably 4 or 5 factors. The first of all is that Taiwan exercised the border examination, border control very early on. I think December 31st last year, Taiwan started its border examination for all the inbound flights from the Wuhan. And then later on, the border examination started to extend it to other areas in China or other countries where they have a more severe COVID-19 cases. So that the early border control, that is one of the factors that help us to control and manage the situation. And second is that due to the horrible experience that Taiwan had 17 years ago due to the SARS and pandemic, Taiwan established a central epidemic command center, which integrates various departments within the government and basically take the whole government approach to deal with this pandemic. And I think the central epidemic command center play a very important role in taking the charge and getting the information, also leading the fight against a pandemic. And also that streamlines and harmonize all the different departmental their approaches and also to integrate all kinds of resources all together to deal with these issues. So that helps us to be a more effective manager on this one. And the third, this time, Taiwan, we are also able to integrate varied data sources to help us to do other things. Due to the existence of Taiwan Universal Health Systems, that we already established the personal health records, and now this time, the personal health records also got integrated with other data such as personal travel histories, the issue about how their telephone tell them their whereabouts and so forth. So that all the data integrated together help the government to can really pin down the problem about where the possible contact cases might happen and how people within that proximity could need to be notified as well as need to be traced. So that helped the Taiwan's health authority to manage the problem about the contact tracing quite a bit. So I'll say that this is another very important lesson that we learned. But of course, by integrating all those different data all together and lead it to the central government to have the access to manage, that also gave the way about the privacy issue. And that's going that has been in a very hot discussion within Taiwan about how transparent, how authoritative the government can have in those data. And the fourth is that about the personal protection equipment and other medical equipments, this government takes a very early action in trying to ensure that, first of all, our medical personnel, and then second, our general public, to have enough the medical resources for their own personal protection. And I think that measure, although earlier, results some disputes within the society and to a certain extent with other outside government, but then later on it proved to be one of the key factor for the success, because due to the bountiful supply of the medical equipment for our medical personnel, that we are able to have the full capacity to deal with the pandemic. And that also gave the people, general public, the confidence about Taiwan's capacity to manage these issues. And that goes also another, the final factor is that the government itself has the public communication sessions every day. And that served to be a very important confidence builder, as well as the people there, since they are aware of the situation, so they reduce possible social panic and other unforeseen social chaos that probably will emerge due to the confusions. So that those factors really help the Taiwan to deal with those issues. But some of the lessons that Taiwan can have probably were not applicable to others, such as the existing universal health systems. Probably other countries they haven't established yet, but this is an advantage that we have. And then when we look at the situation from now on, as Taiwan right now is thinking about the next stage, that is transition from the pandemic to the post-pandemic era. And one of the problem that we are facing is that due to the fact that we do not exercise a very harsh social control and limitation on personal freedom. And so the problem about the so-called revitalization, the pressure is not really on the Taiwan itself, but the problem about the emergency relief, especially due to the downgrade of the economic and other social activities, that result to a lot of the mid and small-sized business whether they are just a vendor store or other smaller business, they are in great pressure trying to survive during this time. So the government right now, the emergency relief measures are already been employed about 3 weeks ago and announced that we are in this phase trying to bring this emergency relief to all the necessary the people they need. But due to the confusion and the very complex procedures for people to apply for the emergency relief, so that becomes another big controversy this government right now is facing trying to deal with a pandemic. So yes, we are a little bit in the phase of transition from the pandemic to the post-pandemic, but the emergency relief becomes one of the big headaches right now this government is facing. And then as we see down the road, that about the future, what the government is expecting is that due to the different recovery rate of different countries facing a pandemic, some country probably can recover faster, trying to bring back to a normal social economic life, and some country they are still in a fight against this. And since Taiwan is in need with external engagement, so that even though Taiwan can survive its own or deal with issue relatively successfully, but if other country surrounding Taiwan and our partners, overseas partner, they are still in a fight, that Taiwan just cannot survive on its own. So that is another reason why the government has been very eager to assist in any way we can to our foreign partners. If they request for the help, we could assist them any way we can. But we also noticed that another requirement probably from now on that will enter the new social and economic norm for the globalization. That is the new requirements about the sanitation and the health certificate or the requirements for all the socioeconomic activity. Probably later on, that'll be the one of the added necessary elements if we really want to sustain this globalization process. So we're going to see the globalization that in a way that we see this before, new requirements related with medical sanitation that probably will be in. But then how to have this or how are you able to establish a standardized or at least harmonize the different health or sanitation standards among different countries so that we can sustain this globalization? I think this is another very important issue we need to have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lai. You really have set up, I think, the bridge into our discussion by pushing us to think about the post-pandemic period or how we try to get there, but also raising the question, I think, about how much of what we've just heard from our four presenters in these experiences in East Asia and Southeast Asia are, in fact, transferable and possible best practices and lessons learned. We now have about 20-25 minutes for discussion. I will try to pose a couple broad questions, and then we'll also gather some questions from our public audience, which I'll also pose for the four of you. I think I'd like to ask a kind of looking back and looking forward question simultaneously, if I can. I mentioned earlier that there seemed to be a kind of diversity of systems politically. And so I wonder to what extent is there some element of good governance, effective and efficient governance, unique modes of government, and perhaps some common characteristics that we can identify that might be possible lessons for reopening. So I'd like to ask each of you to look back a little. You've given broad presentations, very, very informative, sweeping in some cases. And I'm just wondering if you could identify just one or two aspects of the experience in your country or particularly the municipalities. Was it outreach to community stakeholders? Was it the coordination between central and municipal authorities? Was it, say, technology or the transparent release of data and clear guidelines to the public? Take your pick, but urge you to think of just one or two things and let me know, is this something that could be transferred or not? And let's start in the same order in which we went, starting with Professor Zhang. speaking about Vietnam and Hanoi.
Sure. So reflecting back, I think very consistent with the theme of my presentations, the two key things for us, for Vietnam and Hanoi, certainly has been the close coordination, both upward and downward. And that is critical because, as some has argued, it is not political regime type or GDP that can generate public trust and state capacity, but really state capacity to marshal centralized resources. And in order to then effectively distribute those resources, then coordination up and down the command chain is needed. And that is enabled by solid governance, by transparency measure, by responsiveness, which is what Vietnam has been striving for.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Lung, any perspectives on this question?
I think that the most important would be the very important sociological imprint of SARS. And of course, before that, in 1997, the first identified bird flu outbreak, which spread to humans as well. So I think our 20-year experience with these newly emergent epidemics and pandemics, but particularly SARS, I think, in 2003, was really what made the huge difference. Over.
Oh, that's I really appreciate that remark. I myself actually lived through the outbreak of SARS in Hanoi in early 2003 with two small children. And I can tell you, as I live in Arlington, Virginia today, I have, I think, a different sociological view of all of this. And I find myself being perhaps more on the cautious side as a result. Now let's move to Mr. Lee, and any remarks or thoughts on this question from Seoul?
Yeah, well, thank you. And I would like to talk about 3 points. And as you said, that not all the experience and the practice measure can be applicable to, you know, the globally. But I think there is some underlying and cross-cutting issue, which can be, we need to learn from the mistake from the past. I think this is very important from the Korea cases. And we have a very severe damage caused by the 2015 and by the MERS. And we have a very difficulty to contact tracing the peoples. And there is a coordination problem. And also the information provided by the people was infected was not accurate enough. And the virus moved quickly before we, the governments and authority, to act. So after the MERS, there has been quite a number of changes on the infections and the quarantine measure in Korea. So this is something that everybody can share. And number two can be, I would say, agility of the government. And although we cannot say about every moment, every step the Korean government has taken, and but let me give you one example. And early January, and that's some time that there's very few news and little news about the coronavirus. And but in the January, early January, Korea quarantine officials and also the medical and healthcare business people has gathered and tried to learn about the virus. And that's the time the Chinese has been released the samples of the virus, and the Korean authority has been released it. This sample to the medical and healthcare profession. So let them prepare. And that's one of the key measures that, you know, where Korea is able to quickly test, you know, a lot of the possible cases. And third is, I will say, is the transparencies and the providing the full information. And I think that many of government and the country around the world have facing difficulties enforcing the social distancing, and also, you know, the lockdown. But I think Korea was that the people are more able to, citizens are more able to trust the people and the government, because we do not disintegrate people, you know, the information. We provide all the information to the people and let the people, let the citizen decide. This is
area of hotspot. The government say this is, hotspot. People are trying to stay away from that. So I think giving the transparency and the full, amount of information was very critical to work with, the people and also with local government.
Thank you. Mr. Lai? Let's see, Mr. Lai, I think we can't hear you.
Sorry. Yes, I just mute my mic. I think in Taiwan, I would attribute two factors. One of them is a very active public engagement with the with the general public by the government. Every 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the health minister came out and reported to the to our nationals about the cases and development and what are the characteristic of those development is. And so that basically serve a function for the reassurance among the public, as well as how to bring them up to date about the current situation. Another thing that evolved the transparency is that our transparency is not just about the government telling the public. It's also how to empower our public and individual for them to be able to find out the situation by themselves. One example is that our digital minister, who help with our technicians to develop a very interesting app to help them to help the every citizen in Taiwan to be able to locate and know about the number of the personal protection equipment in all the drugstore or all different locations, so that not only they will shorten their search time for to find out the where the available resource is, but they could also find out by themselves exactly about the kind of the amount of the necessary resources where they can find, and that they can also do the math for themselves. So that when individuals being brought into an enabler for the for the information as well as the estimation, I think that not only reduce the possible social chaos, but also increase the level of the public and the governmental corporations. So I think that's a very important lesson that we learned this time.
Thank you. I think one common theme I've been hearing throughout is the transparent and effective release of, I think, actionable information to the public is something that is a lesson I've certainly learned from this discussion. I want to ask one more quick question about how second wave infections are being prevented most effectively. Is there anything from your respective cities and so on that we can identify? And Professor Zhang, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes. And so for Vietnam, in some ways, the second wave has already started, at least a mini one, with international arrivals, Vietnamese expat from around the world coming back to the country. And so Vietnam has employed very similar measures that we've heard from other panelists, other experts, which is mandatory testing, mandatory quarantines. If it's a positive test, then they have to go through centralized quarantine camps, which are run by army units, usually outside of big metro areas. So Hanoi has coordinated closely with the army, as I've mentioned before. The army is in charge of transporting people from different locations and ensuring of that process. Mm-hmm. And the army also is in charge of running the military camps. Yeah. So that has been ongoing in Vietnam for several months now. And they continue to plan doing that to quickly identify and localize potential infectious cases.
I know that's been very effective and reported on. I don't know how transferable that would be in some cases. Dr. Lung, any thoughts on this specific question? I know you touched on it a bit in your presentation, but any thoughts as we close out the discussion soon here?
I think that it's important to really ramp up testing. Mm-hmm. Testing and tracing are the cornerstones of a successful lift to prevent the second wave, or at least to prevent a large second wave. So I think systematic testing and proactive testing, not just those who show some symptoms, but even amongst high-risk groups who are more susceptible to COVID, or at least the complications of COVID, as well as high exposure groups who have frequent and intense social contact with a rather large number of people. So, for example, people who work on public transport systems, people at the retail level, including supermarket cashiers, and so on and so forth. So I think testing and tracing are absolutely key, because that is one control knob that you must dial up if you try to dial down the physical distancing control knob over.
Yeah, very well put. Thank you. Mr. Lee from Seoul, on that question?
Well, I have to echo the previous speaker, and testing is very important. And as I mentioned in my introductory intervention, that we have a recent case of infection spreading at the bars and nightclub. And what we found is since this area are visited by the young people, and the problem is after they go back to their homes and meet the family, and there is a second infection to their elderly and their parents and grandparents. So that raised a lot of concern. But we're also, even at the cases, what we have done is we have rigorously testing all the people, not only who visited the bar, and basically that if the person were near the area, we have a club has been visited by about 300, 400 people, but we have tested about 10,000 people around the perimeter. So I think this is one way to be tackled. Mm-hmm. And but when you talk about the second wave, I think it's really that we have to wait and see how it's going to be unveiled. And in East Asia and Asia Pacific, and this is May, and we're entering the summer season, the temperature is going up. But as we visited autumns or winter, and that's the one, when we have the flu season. And that's the one time the people are relaxed, the car, and also there will be the more freedom of people are coming in and out using the, port of entry. Mm. And I think that's really the, testing time for to see that the virus has been ended, or that we are still are just, going the, first phase at this moment.
Mm. Thank you. Mr. Lai, do you have a quick answer to that? I want to get to, we have about 10 minutes left for questions from our public audience.
Yeah, I think for Taiwan, fortunately, that before the second wave coming in, especially from those people returning from the overseas trip, our control on the first wave already been underway and well managed, so that we have excess capacity to deal with those problems. And also, we established a very elaborate procedures to follow and to really get to analyze the kind of cluster that possibly will be highly likely to be exposed to the pandemic. And so that limits and help us to really focus on the target testing rather than general testing. And that also save a lot of the medical resources to deal with this issue.
Thank you. Now, just to turn and finish our rich discussion here with some questions from our public audience. I have a question from Wayne Wheeler from the American Association of Community Colleges. And he would like to hear from our speakers about plans to reopen schools, colleges, and universities. Let me just ask if anybody has a particular response to that. John, do you have any quick thoughts? And then let's move through.
Sure. So in Vietnam, school have started reopening for children age 5 and up. But one thing that's very much on everyone's mind, especially people with college age students, is that many of them are slated to go abroad to attend colleges. And so they are waiting to see what is going on, not only just in Vietnam, but also in other countries in terms of public, in terms of higher educations, so that they can make plans for college and universities.
Yep. Dr. Lung?
Schools have not actually restarted yet, although all the high school level public exams are ongoing, as are, at least in my medical school, all the exams. And the universities, as well as the high schools, are going to be restarted in a couple of weeks' time and then followed by the primary schools. But I think, let me just add as a general comment, that we still haven't quite figured out what is the relative susceptibility and the infectiousness of children and young people. And I think that's critical to work out by the infectious disease epidemiology and modeling community so as to inform the science behind whether or not class suspension continues to be a good idea, given, of course, the very likely possibility of a second wave coinciding with the fall semester. Over.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Lee?
Well, I have just one thing, and the last week, our education ministry, along with the health and quarantine authority, has announced a school schedule for reopening the school. And first, it's going to be open for the grade 12 who need to go to colleges. And after that, will be, you know, the one only one year can be accepted. So, for example, the grade 11 for high school can enter the week after, and year 10 will be entered the week after that. And also the even the middle and elementary school will be admitted by the, you know, about only the one, you know, the 1 year for each week. So we like to test whether like you know, the periodically accepting those students are able to, you know, the lower the, you know, spread of a virus. And however, that during it this time that we are the, all the Korean student has been able to study online with you know, the, you know, the digital technology. So this is also the, you know, really important testing for the how the, you know, the remote education will be, you know, the played in the future.
Thank you. And Mr. Lai, please.
Taiwan did not. We did not close our school, so we don't have the issue about how to reopen it. Yeah. So, but we do have the various procedure for student or any people want to enter school, like taking temperature. People are required to wear mask, and basically those necessary personal protection procedure they need to follow. So, I think that's basically it.
Okay. We only have about 3 or 4 minutes left, and I would like to get to one more question from our public audience. And it might be a nice segue, because it's a little bit sectoral into the next session. But Amjad Ali from PAC-US TV Network has asked, he's asking a question about the opening of public transportation in particular, and how can this possibly be done safely, allowing for social distancing. It seems like a very key factor for getting cities and economies more broadly opened up. I know Professor Nguyen, the density of Hanoi in particular is having lived there is quite extreme. And so how does one open up public transportation in a safe way, for instance, in Hanoi? And then let's just do a lightning round here, just quick responses from all of you on this question, if you want to jump in.
Well, I think that's, for Vietnam, that's an ongoing process, an ongoing debate. They have slowly allowed public transportation to restart. But I think the leadership is monitoring closely to see whether this will work and whether this will create local outbreaks. And so very much an experimentation in progress.
Thanks. Dr. Lung?
I think really universal face masks or face coverings and also flexible work days and work hours whenever possible, including the possibility of alternating half days at school so that you basically thin the crowd out over the normal peak hours. Over.
Thank you. Mr. Lee?
Well, I just echo the same with Sir Gabriel. And since the last week, the Korea, metropolitan city of Seoul has announced no mask and no metro. So you must wear the, you know, the mask to, you know, to use the public transportation. And also the, you know, since the outbreak and the business and also government has using the flexible working hour. So not everybody has to go to work at 9 o'clock and return by 6. So people are flexible in working time.
Thank you. And Mr. Lai, you'll have to tell us how relevant this is.
Well, I think the Taiwan never closes transportation, but I think basically it goes to the individual level. How the individual personal protection equipment that has been prepared for them, and you need to wear masks, and you need to have very good personal hygiene, that you wash hands in every different locations. That probably will be the safest way to ensure the activity and to do the thing that you wanted.
All right. Well, I want to thank all four of our panelists for giving us really on the ground, rich and sophisticated understanding of what's going on in Hanoi, Hong Kong, Seoul, and Taipei. And with that, I will hand it back over to my colleague, Cheng Li, to wrap up and transition us to the next session. And again, thanks very much to our four panelists and for taking time and being with us here.
Could you hear? Yeah. Okay, good. Thank you, Jonathan. And thank you to all of our speakers for a truly informative and inspiring discussion. Your stories, experiences, lessons, and recommendations have shown us the importance of coming together as an international community to solve our common dilemmas. The outbreaks and the rapid spread of COVID-19 and the need, and perhaps even more importantly, caution for economic reopening all reflect the imperative for international cooperation. In confronting global challenges like this, we will benefit from sharing our wisdom and ideas. Now, I look forward to hearing from friends, old and new, in our second panel discussion. Now, I will turn over the program to my colleague, Maria Solis, to chair that discussion from the perspective of economic sectors. Over to you, Maria.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Good morning, good evening for those listening from Asia and participants from Asia as well. I'm Mireya Solis, Director of the Center for East Asia Policy Studies. And I want to thank everybody for joining us for this second panel, where we will have a closer look at the reopening experiences from a broad range of economic sectors in East Asia, from the role of digital technologies to the manufacturing sector and the operation of supply chains, to the food and beverage sector, property markets, and the travel and hospitality industry. The question of economic revitalization looms very large, as the global health crisis has disrupted production and depressed consumption all over the world. We are in fact confronting the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, and Asia has not escaped unscathed. On the contrary, the IMF's GDP projections for the 2020 year, for this year, are suffering 0% growth. Our purpose today is to provide a rich and granular understanding of how different economic sectors in the region are coping with the pandemic, but also to gain insight into what reopening will bring about. what will the new normal be as we attempt to restart economic activity while still battling the new coronavirus? We're thrilled to have a distinguished group of panelists with deep understanding of key economic sectors. Let me introduce them briefly in the order in which they will offer their initial remarks. Kai-Fu Lee is the chairman and CEO of Sinovation Ventures, a company devoted to promoting high-tech entrepreneurship. Before that, Dr. Lee was president of Google China, and I should also note that he's a best-selling author with his book, AI Superpowers, China, Silicon Valley, and the New World Order. Jane Sun is the chief executive officer of the Trip.com Group, with extensive experience in the online travel business. She has received many distinctions, including in 2017, when she was named as one of the most influential and outstanding business women by Forbes China. Keijiro Hora is a chief representative of the Americas region for Mitsubishi Electric Corporation and the president and chief executive officer for Mitsubishi Electric US. Mr. Hora has been a leader in the electronics and manufacturing sector for more than three decades and brings expertise in industrial technology, strategic business development, and marketing, particularly in Asian and North American markets. Terry Tsao is the Global Chief Marketing Officer and President of SEMI Taiwan, where he leads a strategic, operational, and communication marketing. And prior to joining the Semiconductor Association, Mr. Tsao was Managing Director of International Data Corporation. And last but not least, Robert Greaves is the founder, chairman, and CEO of Hamilton Advisor, a strategic communications firm, and he's also the 2019 chairman of the American Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong. Previously, Mr. Greaves had a career in journalism, writing for The Times, The Economist, and Time magazine. I would like to encourage everyone to send us your questions. We want to include you in the conversation, so please reach out to us via email or Twitter. And with that, I would like to turn things over to our moderator, my colleague, David Dollar, who is a senior fellow at the China Center and a leading scholar on the Chinese economy and global supply chains. With that, over to you, David.
Thank you very much, Maria. It's a great pleasure to moderate this discussion among this distinguished group of panelists. I won't say much to start because we want to get right into the discussion. We're interested in how sectors are recovering and getting back to operation, but I'm also interested in the longer-term question of how sectors may change on a more permanent basis. And so we're going to start with Kai-Fu Lee, and I hope everyone can stick to about 5 to 7 minutes for their initial comments. And I'll just remind you, you have to unmute your mic when you start. Please, Mr. Lee.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for inviting me to this panel. Some of my company, Sinovation, operates in China. We've been back in business for the last 2 months or so after an initial period of problem. I think the entrepreneurial environment is now really bustling with energy. We are talking to companies using online mechanisms, but also able to now meet offline. So I think overall, I would say the whole country is back up and running, including the sector of high-tech entrepreneurship and investment. But I think what might be more interesting to talk about is what are the technological implications of post-COVID-19. One that everyone talks about is digitization. We're spending much more time online with learning, telemedicine, and working from home and having sessions like this. I think the important thing from a technology standpoint is that this forms a habit. And habits take, on the average, 70 days to form. And that's just about the amount of time it takes for us to shift from old style meetings to new style and old style entertainment to new style and so on. And the further implication is that once things are digitized, where we have more data. Once there's more data, then AI can be enabled. So a lot of opportunities like that will arise. To give you one example, one of the grand challenges, and arguably could take my whole lifetime and probably won't see the results, is that of building a digital human in real life, right? Building a robot that can touch and see and walk is so difficult. But when we're seeing each other, not in real life, but in video conferencing, building a digital human like what you see of me is really quite relatively easy. Something that's photorealistic, human-like, is engaging, speaks like humans. It's within reach right now. And what this means is that in the future, when you're in a video conferencing, listening to a lecture by a teacher, talking to a chatbot for a human-looking chatbot for medical assistance, getting customer support, being contacted by sales, you won't know if it's human or AI. And that, I think, is a big change riding on top of digitization. In terms of sectors that can ride this wave with AI and data, of course, healthcare is at the very center. And that goes from disease pandemic prediction in the future. Things like wearables will create a lot more sensored data to make accurate predictions to avoid pandemics like this. And of course, drug discovery and also uses of AI with all the data gathered in the future of smart diagnosis smart radiology and so on and so forth. I believe in the future, it's inevitable that AI becomes a very powerful assistant to doctors, and that will get accelerated by the pandemics. With education, about 1 billion children are taking classes remotely. Today, still largely by human teachers, but we are actually have a portfolio of companies that are building AI teachers that are indistinguishable from human teachers, and furthermore has the exciting characteristic of being able to target content for each student and making learning more fun, engaging, with the quantitative results showing students are learning better. So these virtual teachers, I think, is going to be a surprising thing coming out of this. Social distancing makes us want to not have people contact people too much, especially those in jobs, in service jobs, transportation jobs, and jobs that healthcare jobs that require a lot of contact. So the use of robotics, from autonomous vehicles for delivery and robots for delivering medical supplies, have been installed in China and really taking off. Now, the final idea is a little double-edged sword, and that is with the economic pressure that companies now face, people look at cost-cutting. And there are a lot of AI and high-tech technologies that for automation that have not had pervasive adoption. For example, RPA, robotic process automation. It basically is there to replace people doing routine white-collar jobs. But some companies have been slow to adopt. But now that we're digitizing work anyway, rather than letting employees work from home doing routine job, why not have a software process? So the uptake of RPA is just going through the roof worldwide, and many jobs are being automated. These are jobs like back office, customer service, entry-level accounting, HR, legal, and so on. And once these jobs are automated, they're never coming back. So I'm quite excited about the efficiency benefits, but also concerned that when some of these workers are ready to come back to work after the pandemic, the job may not be there.
Okay, thank you very much, Shirley. That was very interesting and very focused time-wise, so I appreciate that. We're going to turn now to Jane Sun, totally different sector, travel. It's been the sector that's probably been most hit by the coronavirus. Jane, please.
Thank you for having me. Our sector is badly hit by the coronavirus, and I would like to walk you through the three stages we are in, and we will be in. The first phase is the crisis mode. When China adopted a lockdown policy, hundreds and millions of cancellation and the reordering came to our call center. So we have been working very hard to take our to take care of our customers. We launched 100 million natural disaster relief fund to help our customers. We also bring in our partners to launch 1 billion working capital for the ecosystem and 10 billion loans to inject it in the travel industry just to make sure our partners are well protected and well supported. And also for our employees during this crisis mode, we adopted very swift measures to make sure they are very well protected. Now, after January and February, at the end of March, we start to see the recovery. So if you look at the pollution rate in China, coal usage in China, and also the export rate, all these indexes have seen a positive recovery, which indicate a normalization of the Chinese economy. And it's also reflected gradually in a travel industry. So we have to be very innovative to increase the confidence in the consumer's heart. So what we did is a couple of things. First of all, when we start to recover the travel industry, we need to make sure that the consumers who are so concerned about the virus are very well protected. So we adopted a safety standard for all the hotels, airlines, local tour operators, rental car companies, so that the locations are very, very well sanitized, temperatures are taken, prevention methods are adopted. And for those companies who adopt these safety standards, they got very good volumes at the beginning. Secondly, we also talk to our partners and our consumers. For example, for the hotels, the occupancy rate right now is very low at about 10% or 20%. However, the demand from the high-end customers is quite high because they have been locked down for so long, they're eager to travel. So what we did is to have talk to our hotel partners. They take out these perishable inventory and giving very good discount to the consumers. And in return, we ask our customers to prepay for these products. The deal they get is so good. For example, they will get a 5-star hotel, 2 Michelin restaurant dinner, a free meal, for breakfast for only $150, which normally will sell at $500. In return, our hotel partners will get some cash flows to supplement their operations and reduce their loss. So we are very much leading the recovery in the process. And thirdly, we're also using all kinds of innovative methods to reach out to the market. For example, we use live streams to reach out at all the social platforms using different methods to wake the customers who have been sleeping during the crisis mode. So by doing that, we have seen 50% recovery during the last Labor Day weekend. And I'm very eager to wait for the Congress meeting, which is going to take place at the end of May. Hopefully, the government will send a strong message to resume the economic activities and encourage city-to-city, state-to-state travel. And by that time, the travel industry will even recover more to 80 to 90% compared to the last year. Now, looking forward, the third stage will be challenging but rewarding. We have seen in the first panel that Korea, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Vietnam, even Singapore and Japan, these countries are very disciplined in making sure the outbreak of the virus is very well under control. So we are working very hard with the travel bureau in these countries, and hopefully the government will have adopted a certain standard like what we have in China. For example, in Shanghai, we have a green health code. And in Beijing, the code is also green. So a person from Shanghai who has a green health code, when he or she travels to Beijing, he doesn't need to be quarantined. And if we can do that for bilateral relationships between China and Korea, or China or Vietnam, China and Singapore, that will expedite the inter-nation travel and further recover these travel industry, which is badly needed. As we can see, travel accounts for 10% of the GDP and provides 10% of the job opportunity. So at this moment, if we can collaboratively work together as one global, one team, it will be very critical for the recovery for Asia. And if it is, if we hold Asia very strongly, then we will inject positively in the global economy. So hopefully, with the influential audience today, we can work together and make it happen in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And so now we're going to turn to Kajiro Hora from Mitsubishi Electric.
Hey, thank you. Good morning, everyone. Thank you, David and Miria-san, for the opportunity to join this panel today. So I'm Keijiro Hora from Mitsubishi Electric. So my company have a diverse range of products used in many industries. My product include satellite, semiconductor, building systems, energy infrastructure, automotive electronics, the factory automation like that. And we have around 140,000 employees overall. And also we have many factories in US and also many in Asia countries such as China, Thailand, Vietnam, and Malaysia. And the same as the almost all manufacturers, COVID-19 continue to affect our business operations. To a certain extent, Mitsubishi Electric has been able to navigate the operational and logistical challenge of the pandemic in the Asian region. So first, while Mitsubishi Electric briefly closed in February a portion of our factory in China, so we do not have any manufacturing operational in Wuhan area. And the second, in recent years, Japan has endured disasters and unforeseen events, including massive earthquakes and incidents such as tsunami. Those impact of these types of events has served to accelerate our contingency planning for and ensure that our supply chain is that diversified and resilient. So we have also established a protocol whereby almost all our overseas factories have a backup in the form of a mother factory in Japan. So if a catastrophic event disrupts operations at one of our factory, factory in Japan or the other country is usually able to take on this additional capacity. However, for Mitsubishi Electric, a more significant reaction reason for the slowing our production line in a certain sector like HVAC or building systems, factory automation, and transportation is decreased market demand given massive financial uncertainties. So from a financial perspective, we are currently forecasting that our revenue will decline around 8% in this fiscal year. This is a huge impact to us. As we gradually reopen our facility across the world, one of our biggest challenges is ensuring the safety to our employees and their families. To do so, we are making significant changes in the design of our factories and offices so that sufficient spacing exists and personal protective equipment is available. And as for the, my recommendation in the pandemic-driven world that we are facing, is manufacturers should create the solution that offer an added layer of safety to the product that we produce and find new uses for existing technologies. And our R&D labs, as well as the Innovation Center in Japan and Silicon Valley, are now working toward developing these new technologies and bringing them to market as soon as possible. And for example, to minimize contact with the virus transmission surface, our latest generation of the elevator can be equipped with a touch-free technology that connect with your smartphone to eliminate the need to interact with any elevator surface area until the destination floor to arrive. So we are hopeful that the other product that we manufacture can be further engineered so they contribute to the fight against COVID-19. So in addition to this, Mitsubishi Electric has joined the several other companies and organizations in signing the Open COVID-19 Declaration for the intellectual property. So this group of the company in Japan has preached that during this pandemic period, we will not assert any patent rights for products that could contribute to stopping the spread of COVID-19, including for diagnosis, prevention, containment, and treatment. We opened IP free to use for this specific objective. So as Mr. Kai-Fu Lee mentioned, digitalization and using AI technology to be deeply applied in the future to work for the COVID-19 to protect our own intellectual property in the field of AI, 5G, precise GPS location systems, and thermal imaging, and so on, could contribute to fight against COVID-19. In closing, let me know that it is important that the private sector work together with government and the scientific community in eliminating COVID-19. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hora. And now we're going to turn to Terry Tsao from Semi Taiwan.
Good morning and good evening, everyone. I'm Terry from Semi. SEMA is a global industry association. We serve the semiconductor and the microelectronic industry society. So we have around 2,000 members around the world. So we get sometimes get some firsthand information about the industry dynamic and also their latest feedback about the COVID-19. In terms of the COVID-19, this pandemic, I think in the short term, semiconductor industry, we don't really get the severe or like a big like hit. The reason why is actually from demand side, we see because of the pandemic, actually we have more electronic usage, everyone work from home, so that you need more either the hardware or you have to subscribe the internet service, or like us, we have the video conference, or even we as an association, we traditionally we host the physical trade show and conference. Now we have to do the virtual conference or virtual trade show even, or the hybrid type of the event. So actually from the demand side, we don't see the big a slowdown at this moment for all the electronic product. But on the other hand, this is from the demand side. From the supply side, for the high-tech manufacturing industry, especially semiconductor industry, it's already kind of fully automation. So most of the fab and also the manufacturing process is already being automated. So actually, either from the demand side or from the supply side, at this moment, we don't see the significant like impact in the short term. Like I check with most of the famous like foundry, number one foundry in Taiwan or number one like OSAT packaging house in Taiwan, they have very good business in the first quarter or second quarter. Of course, in the long term, probably this pandemic make the people like worry about the future, begin to like slow down the purchasing, more conservative about the spending. But at this moment, most of the supply side or the manufacturing side, we kind of stay in the optimistic, cautious optimistic situation. But going forward, we definitely believe that, especially in manufacturing industry, how we adapted or leverage the concept of the smart manufacturing, or we talk about the industrial 4.0, I think definitely that will be the big driver for most of the company. They will manufacturing industry. They will elevate their facility. Take semiconductor manufacturing, the foundry or the fab, for example. Actually, only very, very few people, they work in the fab. It's already fully automation. And also, we can place the recipe and place the order from remote. So some, for example, some Taiwanese semiconductor manufacturing company, they have the fab in China. So mm-hmm. when China, they have some like a pandemic, like a spread out, actually, the staff, they can work from Taiwan, they place the order, they can buy the cloud and the remote to control the machine equipment who can, based on the instruction, to do the production in China. So definitely we can foresee in the manufacturing industry, especially high-tech manufacturing industry, the driver will be very strong to facilitate the company to enhance how to do the more automation, smart manufacturing. I think that will be the big trend for the manufacturing industry. And of course, on the other hand, from the application side, the 5G, AI, and also the smart medtech will be the driver for the demand side. Definitely, those are the big factor will drive the semiconductor industry for the bigger usage in the coming future. So that's my summary for the overall about the manufacturing industry and the high-tech manufacturing industry. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Cao. And our last panelist is Robert Greaves from the American Chamber of Commerce in Hong Kong. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you. Good morning and good evening to you all. The American Chamber has about 1,400 members, half of whom are non-American. And when we look at Hong Kong, as Dr. Lung said in the earlier presentation, Hong Kong has done a very good job in containing COVID-19. And it's part of this is because of SARS. Part of it is because they had that experience. The people are compliant and disciplined in Hong Kong. They also were by themselves cleaning subdivided housing for free for poor people, which was fantastic. So the great volunteer spirit, the medical establishment here is great. When we turn to the economic sphere, as the previous two speakers were talking, there's a lot of great stuff with blockchain, AI, high tech that could help areas out of the virus situation, the pandemic going into the future. In Hong Kong, not the case so much, and I want to focus on leisure, food and beverage, also property and the airline industry. So if you look at food and beverage and leisure, we are dependent. We're a world city. We are dependent on tourism. We are dependent on people from mainland China coming down and using our facilities, tourism, going into the shops, going to the bars and restaurants, going into the hotels. And all of this has been stopped in its tracks. The economy has contracted at 8.9% year over year. Just to jump to Cathay for a moment, they are 96% down in their capacity in part by design. Because the other factor here is you don't want to have a second wave of infection, and that's another part of this equation. So we have had a number of, you can see in the Soho section of Hong Kong, also in Knutsford Terrace, in TST across the water, boarded up shops, restaurants closed, bars closed. Many of these will never open, thousands of these across Hong Kong. Many of them will never open again. This is a huge impact on a city that's been known for its F&B. The hotels are in single-digit occupancy right now, and they're having to basically wall off sections of the hotel, and people are not staying there. So this is a big drag on the economy. When it comes to property for a minute, I'll just dwell on this for a minute. Property is a really important part of Hong Kong. Prices are coming down in terms of commercial real estate and residential, but probably not fast enough. And the example of this is a big realtor just the other day had to pull out of selling lots on the old Kai Tak Airport on the TST side of the harbor, and lost money. This doesn't happen in Hong Kong, and it's happening now. And when you turn to the airlines, Cathay Pacific really is a poster child for Hong Kong's dilemma, which is basically based on 19th century industries, finance, real estate, that sort of thing. The two previous speakers were talking about all the things that are developed across Shenzhen Bay and Shenzhen, but not in Hong Kong. And this is something we talk about. Will Hong Kong have to reinvent itself post-pandemic? And how do you do that? And how do you work with other cities in the Greater Bay Area to do that? So I'm not introducing great ideas for getting out of the situation. I'm actually identifying three problems that the Hong Kong government and the Hong Kong people have to deal with. And I will stop right there.
Okay, thank you very much, Robert. Since we have five panelists, what I'd like to do is I have a couple of questions, but I want to try to avoid having all five panelists answer the same question. So I have a manufacturing question I'd like to address to Kai-Fu Lee and Mr. Hora and Mr. Cao. And then I have a separate question I want to direct toward Jane and Robert. So starting with Kai-Fu Lee, the manufacturing question, the pandemic has definitely started a lot of talk about reshaping value chains, that firms, you know, might be rethinking having such global value chains. And then I think that intersects with this trade war between China and the U.S., leaving China. Japan has some stimulus money for Japanese firms to return back to Japan. So looking past the immediate crisis, do we really think global value chains are going to be, and how do you see them changing over, say, a 5 or 10 year time horizon, starting with Kai-Fu Lee?
Okay. Well, China is the world's manufacturer. I think it's becoming the world's most high-quality manufacturer over the last 20, 25 years. And I think that role is not going to be very easy to replace. There are some lower-cost electronics and products that have been shifting to Southeast Asia and South America and so on. But I know many companies in the U.S., that really depend on China for building quality products. And I think that shift will be difficult. However, I also see determination in the U.S. government to try to change the supply chain and reduce the dependency on China. So we'll see how that plays out. I think obviously there are risks if certain key things aren't manufactured in China anymore, are moved off. We see the news about Taiwan Semiconductor recently, for example. But at the same time, there is also an opportunity to build a separate and parallel supply chain with Belt Road Initiative helping the developing countries, building products for Middle East, Africa, Southeast Asia, and so on. So I think it's hard to tell. I think China has some challenges, but also some opportunities, and it has a strong hand in this game at this point.
A quick follow-up for Mr. Li. Very speculative, but looking in terms of the... think the pandemic is more important or the U.S.-China trade war is more important in how value chains evolve in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think both are causing the globalization to become undone, and both are important. But I think the sentiment from U.S. about China and the determination in a bipartisan way is probably the largest challenge right now.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Hora, in your opening remarks, you were emphasizing Mitsubishi's global reach with factories in China, factories in the U.S. You know, how do you see value chains evolving in your sector over the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, that is a great question. But as Mr. Li mentioned, we also have a lot of over 30 factory operations in China and also the Asia as well. It's not easy to shift. Maybe some certain level of shifting, but not only for the U.S.-China trade war, but for the optimization of the supply chain, we will always consider about that. So, of course, the tariff is one of the factor to consider about that.
Terry Tsao, what is your view about how value chains might evolve in response to both the virus and this U.S.-China tension?
Yeah. I think during the time when the virus outbreak, we did do the very quick survey about our global 2,000 semi-member around the world about the diversified the supply chain. I think... 60%, they do have the intention to consider to diversify, not specific one region. Of course, China is one region, but in general, this pandemic really gives a very strong signal for the, all the manufacturing companies to consider about they should diversify the supply chain. However, on the other hand, in semiconductor industry, we have to say that the trade war between the U.S. and China actually made the semiconductor supply chain facing the very difficult challenge. Because in our semiconductor industry, actually this industry is very, by each industry segment, just very separate into around the world. For example, probably the system company like Xiaomi, Huawei in China, or the Apple in US, and they use the IC design chip from Qualcomm from US, by the manufacturing by TSMC in Taiwan, packaging house in ASE in Taiwan, but ASE and the TSMC, they use most of the American companies as the equipment company like applied material. So when we do the trade war, actually make our industry become very in very dilemma situation. And we feel very strong pressure from the Trump administration. So actually, I don't know, have you heard about it? Actually, this is the breaking news this morning in Taiwan. TSMC finally decided to show the intention to make their 5-nanometer fab in Arizona. So it's really from the big pressure from the Trump administration, from U.S. government to diversify the supply chain. First of all, probably they want to give the pressure from Taiwan semiconductor industry, no more supply to Huawei. At the same time, they want to have the semiconductor company to make the investment, the supply chain, not only in China, but also in U.S., so that the Taiwan semiconductor industry, they can be the trusted semiconductor foundry business to U.S. government. So I have to say, I think both factors really give the big driver for the microelectronic, especially semiconductor industry, about how to diversify their supply chain. But one is more from the natural disaster, the other is more from the from administration. Yeah, so I think both are very important factor to make the changes. Yeah.
Thank you. That's fascinating, the three answers. So the combination of the natural disaster and the man-made disaster is powerful. But I take a point that Kai-Fu Lee made. About 20% of world manufacturing is in China right now. And that's the kind of number that doesn't change very rapidly. So this is certainly going to affect some specific sectors, as Mr. Cao was just discussing the very recent developments in semiconductors. We will get some parallel value chains in a few key manufacturing areas, but probably for most manufacturing, we're going to continue to have relatively global value chains. That's what I took away. Now, I have a separate question for Jane and Robert. Jane, you described the somewhat very active effort of hotels and the travel industry, it's particularly in mainland China, to get back customers. But you also mentioned hotels are running at 10 or 20%, and Robert painted a pretty grim picture. So I guess I wonder, in this travel leisure sector, can we really protect consumers and workers and actually have a workable business model, or are we going to see very dramatic contraction in this industry because what you're describing is going to be very expensive and be hard to make a profit in that environment? So Jane first.
Sure. I think within the domestic China business, it's on the right track to recover. At the beginning, the government wants to do it in a very methodical way. So they only allows travels within the same city or within the same province. But our expectation is after the Congress meeting takes place at the end of the May, they will open up more because the May holiday was the first holiday after the recovery. And so far, it went very smoothly. There was no major outbreak. So the government feels confidence that the country needs to be open more. So if the long distance travel is allowed, we expect the travel will take up more momentum. Secondly, after the Congress meeting, more capacity from Beijing Airport will be put in place. And Beijing Airport accounts for about 20 to 30% of the overall capacity because all the major airlines fly into Beijing, and these routes are the major routes between Beijing and the state capital. So we expect the capacity to increase anywhere between 20 to 30%. And that, again, is a trajectory for us to capitalize on to recover the travel industry. When people fly from Beijing to some other cities, that is also very positive for us to do cross-sell to help our hotel partners to get these customers into their property. So in a normal business level, when hotel reaches about 50 to 60% of the occupancy rate, they're at the break-even points. So within domestic China, we are hopeful into Q3, Q4, they will reach that kind of occupancy rate. Another positive factor we should take into consideration is that the wealthy and affluent travelers who normally plan at least 2 to 3 outbound travel to the foreign countries now will look for alternatives within China. So the distance, long distance tour into Tibet, Xinjiang, or the Silk Road will also take these customers because they have nowhere to go except to go to domestic routes. So these are the positive factors for the domestic China travel industry. However, I still think there is an opportunity if government can work on bilateral agreements between China to Korea, China to Japan, China to Singapore, Thailand, Vietnam, even Australia and New Zealand. There is an opportunity. We can assign a green health code to the countries that has very well controlled for the outbreak of the virus. Then we can even inject millions of outbound Chinese travelers into this country. And based on our conversation with this country, they are so eager to receive the Chinese consumers, Chinese travelers, because their airport, their airlines, their hotels are built to host a lot of Chinese customers, anywhere between 20 to 30, 40% of the inbound tourists are from China. So again, that is an opportunity. It's not easy to achieve, but we should be able to accomplish this goal if we work closely with each other.
Thank you, Jane. Robert, you talked about Hong Kong reinventing itself. So what might that look like?
Well, it might mean more interaction with Shenzhen and becoming more of a working with technology companies, maybe having some technology companies in Hong Kong. Remember Frank Wong, who invented DJI, actually was educated at HKUST, but had to go to Shenzhen because he couldn't find the employees or the infrastructure he needed to start his drone company. So the people are looking at that idea. They're looking at what to do with the terminals, the cargo terminals. There's also a huge healthcare component that is growing out of the very world-class and terrific hospital and healthcare system in Hong Kong. So biomedical, biotech, these are areas for the future of Hong Kong. I liked what Jane was saying, her very positive statements, and she was alluding to some sort of system. I think she was alluding to testing and then having some sort of certificate or something that people can carry around with them. I think that's a great idea. I am being pessimistic now because the Hong Kong authorities are being very stringent. They want 28 days with no new cases and no imported cases before they start to lift restraints. We got to 23 cases just recently, but then we had three more cases that were imported. So I think it's coming. And of course, vaccine is on the other side of this, but that could be 18 months, 2 years, whatever down the road. So David, I just want to emphasize that Hong Kong is a world city and it is dependent on the world, as are the other locations we're talking about here, but it is very much dependent. And the airlines and the leisure and hotels, industry, and even property are dependent on having people moving in and out of the city. So I think once we have that nailed, especially the testing, I think things can move forward.
This one I have, I think maybe all of you may want to comment on, but I'm going to start again with Kai-Fu Lee. So Eric, who's a PhD student at the University of British Columbia, he wants to know how all of this is going to affect talent migration. And his question is specifically about talent migration into Asia. But I'm also curious about talent migration out of Asia. Certainly the United States economy has been dependent on a lot of high-skilled immigration coming from Asian countries to the U.S. You know, how do we see that whole mixing of talent changing, starting with Kai-Fu Lee?
Okay. I have been hearing more and more about American schools taking fewer Chinese students, especially in the high-tech areas. That's likely to happen, and that means the Chinese students will either stay at home or go to other countries. That's one possible migration. Another is the continuing Asian Americans, Chinese Americans, being treated unfairly in the U.S. So far, that hasn't led to any exodus, but I would say that's also a factor. In terms of foreign talent coming to China, that's always been a very small number, and I don't imagine that would be material.
Jane?
Yes, we have been promoting inbound travel. So in the very recent announcement by the Prime Minister's office, many of our proposals has been adopted in the country's policy. I think a lot of our friends, before they come to China, they have a little bit misunderstanding about China, but once they are there, they saw the high-speed railway, they saw the high buildings, wonderful schools, etc. The impression changes quite a lot. So what we did for the government is a couple of things. First of all, they need to establish online visa to ease the application for the travelers. Secondly, we need to make more hotels available, open for foreign visitors. Right now, only 20-30% of the hotels are available for foreign visitors. And thirdly, the payment for China right now is very much linked to WeChat Pay and Alipay, but for foreigners, it's a little bit difficult to get through. So there are about 10 items we recommend the government to make it easy for people to travel into China. And then we also recommend government to have an open door policy to attract more students all over the world to study in China. So this, I think, is going to be an opportunity for us to move forward for that, because right now, China seems to be the safest country to attract students to China.
Mr. Hora, do you have some thoughts about how the problems with migration?
Yeah, of course, those restrictions the travel trip is also affect to us a lot for our business. So we also have a lot of operations, and also that we have sending a lot of our company employee for working in China. And also we are dispatching our company employee as a student or a study or analyze to join the R&D in China. So we also have R&D facility in China, and also we have the one in US as well. Therefore, those are both China and US, Japan, and such a huge industry and economy, and also the technology center, it's better to work together, especially for such a tough situation. To fight against COVID-19. That is my recommendation.
Mr. Cao, can you hear me?
Yes.
You have any views on this issue about the talent migration?
In the high-tech industry, probably I should highlight the other perspective. In general, we feel like actually all the innovation and the technology or even the economic growth for most of the country, the most of the part is come from the high-tech or the technology. So actually in our industry, our challenge is more like a talent shortage issue, no matter from which country or region. For us, it's more like how we can attract more people to fundamental. They are more willing to join studying the STEM-related program. And of course, lots of the young talent, they also would like to go to like Google, Facebook. They are more like a fancy job, but fundamental, like in our industry, we always talk about without semiconductor, without everything. So I would rather to interpret the talent issue is more like how we can attract more young talent to join the our industry, no matter from which region. That's our like a talent migration issue where we more critical in our industry. Yeah.
And Robert?
Hong Kong is an open city, so we welcome talent from all over the world, and but the issue is, where are the jobs going to be, and what is the sector going to be where we can attract that talent? And so I think Hong Kong needs to develop areas that will, such as biomedical, such as med tech, biotech, that will attract people from other parts of the world.
Last question, just briefly, but to make a link to the other panel, at the end of the first panel, in discussing the resumption of public transport, everyone endorsed the idea of more flex time. And I have friends in Beijing who are going to work 2 days a week, and people alternate different days, so that gives them a little contact with the office, and then they spend 3 days working at home. But without being an expert, my sense is in manufacturing, it's going to be really hard to have this kind of flex time. So I would like each of you, just if you would like to just address briefly, you know, how realistic is more flex time and spreading out people's commute in the sectors that you're familiar with, starting with Kai-Fu Lee.
Yes, my company operates that way. Because we're in the investment business, we're able to be flexible with the meetings we set up. So people are working 2 to 4 days in the office and can work remotely. I don't think, as you said, I don't think this will work in every industry. And I think, mass transportation is needed. One of the main issues globally is, I think, looking more at wearing masks as a requirement. That's starting to happen, but not pervasive yet. Because the whole idea of a mask is to prevent transmission of someone who has the virus. So it only works if everyone wears it. And I think a lot of the American studies have not been based on that understanding and assumption that every single person has to wear it. And that's, I think, critical to opening up mass transportation.
Yeah, that's one of the things we heard at the end of the first panel. No mask, no metro. Jane?
Our company has resumed back to office to work pretty much starting on February the 17th. However, we make Zoom and offline work available for all employees. I think internally, because we know each other so well, we trust each other, the online communication really works very well, so that we don't have to schedule a conference room and we can call each other anytime. However, certain communications really is necessary. When we work with our customers, with the government agencies, there are lots of pent-up demand for us to visit Beijing after the Congress meeting is finished. So internally and externally, we're treated separately.
Mr. Hora, so in manufacturing, is this remotely realistic?
Actually, remote is not very realistic. Of course, design and R&D or those stage or production planning could be remote. But as for the production factory site, actually, not remote, but for how to optimize the number of the worker or keeping the space, already we've been doing that. For example, actually, depend on the load, we already introduced 2 shift or 3 shift. Sometimes 24 hours. Therefore, to maintain the same volume and also the reducing the number of the worker at the shop, we just shift at the 3. That is possible to consider. And also, not only for the production side, but also to protect our employee and for the for restarting, how to optimize the space. We are introducing such as to not 2 shift or 3 shift, but divide it into 2 team or 3 team or 4 team. Then one team start working, just in case if someone, unfortunately not happened yet to us, but if the one person got the positive, in that case, entire group have to remove and clean up, and another group come in, then start working for that. Well, in case if we have a factory line, 1 line, 2 line, 3 line, also we do that. If 1 line being sometime infected, in that case, we have to clean up everything and to use the another line like that. Now, fortunately, we haven't happened yet to us, but we are preparing for that to protect our employee and to keep the operation stably. That's what you're planning.
Thank you. Terry Tsao?
Yes. I think, like you mentioned earlier, different industry where we have different scenario. And of course, some industry like manufacturing or even like a service industry definitely still need to face-to-face, on-site. But my prediction is more like in the future, there will be more like a hybrid situation. And before really release like a vaccine or all the any like a medical like a cure can be developed, but I'm not too like a I think the actually of course we will continue to use more like a virtual like online meeting, but think about that. Those like a solution we do or already a solution for more than 10 years or 15 years. Like we organize the trade show. Actually, we do have the online like a trade show solution, but people still want to have to build up the relationship. They want to face to face. So I believe once when the pandemic is under control, people still will be very active back to work face to face. I think this still the human, like a people nature. So I think in the future, of course, will be some hybrid model with some virtual things, but I think don't be so worried about that's only like in the future, we only can wear the mask and only the meeting will be only virtual. Yeah, that's my assumption. Yeah.
So that's an optimistic note. Flex time. Please unmute. Robert, we can't hear you.
There we go. Thank you. I think it depends on the industry. F&B and service industries, it's almost impossible. I think in my business, consultancy, it is possible. I think it's a mix. It's not all remote. It's not all in the office. It's a mix. People will move in and out. So you can do that. Manufacturing, I agree, is probably more difficult. And I think in future, there will be more mixing and matching of this over time.
Well, we've run out of time, co-panelists, and I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Maria Solis. I've really enjoyed the discussion, and I'd like to thank you very much and turn it over to Maria.
Thank you very much, David. What a dynamic and insightful conversation you've all had. For me, at least, there were three main takeaways from everything that was said. One is it reconfirmed the importance really to have this kind of discussion that looks at the specific economic sectors. Because frequently we hear about how economies are doing as a whole. And I think that what this panel has captured is that some sectors might thrive with COVID-19 because they'll provide some of the tools that we need as we move to the online platforms. But for other industries, the hospitality sector, the transportation sector, manufacturing will be harder to deal with the realities of these new disease. So again, I think that we captured the complexity and the diverse set of challenges and experiences for different sectors. It also, for me, reminded me of the very important fact that in Asia, we're talking about a very integrated region. And this, I think, presents a set of challenges in the sense that some economies go into lockdown, they begin to reopen when other economies are being hit, and how we handle these lack of alignment, if you will, in the cycles of shutdown and reopening, and also the very interesting conversation that you all had about global supply chains, that the trends were already negative because of tensions on the trade front, but then what does COVID-19 mean for a readjustment of the supply chains, but also the reminder that there's a vast amount of existing integration that cannot be easily undone, should not be easily undone. And also I enjoyed very much getting from all of you a glimpse as to what the new normal might be when we try to restart economic activity, the implications of the shift towards digitalization, how we may change the way in which we work and how this work would work very differently in manufacturing versus services industry. And of course, the all-important fact that before we have a vaccine, we're going to probably be experiencing cycles of restart and shutdown as we deal with this crisis. So thank you very much to all our panelists. For those that are joining us from Asia, I know that we imposed on you that this is a very late evening. I also want to thank David for moderating such a dynamic discussion. And to our audience, thank you for joining. And to remind you that this is just the beginning of similar conversations that the Brookings Institution will be having as we are now moving forward with this project of reopening in America and the world. It's been such a pleasure to host this conversation. Thank you all.